We do not understand what it means to face questions that the human mind cannot fail to ask, and yet simultaneously combine the question with the humility and the awe and the Yirat Hashem to continue to celebrate Pesach without an answer to that question.
The Tikva Fund is proud to present The Haggadah, a political classic, a series of 8 audio recordings that together make up a full course on the most beloved and most popular work of Jewish liturgy. Our teacher is Rabbi Dr. Meir Soloveitchik of Congregation Sherith Israel, the oldest Jewish congregation in the United States. Rabbi Soloveitchik is also the director of the Zahava and Moshe L. Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought at Yeshiva University. In these lectures, you'll hear Rabbi Soloveitchik explore the text of the Haggadah as a source of political and moral wisdom, bringing out its deeper arguments about family, memory, and the human condition, about politics and freedom, about history and sacrifice. This episode is Elijah's Cup, Reflections on Athens and Jerusalem.
Of all the moments at the Seder, two are perhaps most beloved by children. The first is the hiding and the finding of the piece of matzah known as the afikoman, which according to Jewish law is the last bit of food ingested on Pesach night, paralleling the last bite of the Paschal lamb that was eaten in temple times. Now, much of these rituals, hiding, finding, are elaborate schemes to keep children engaged. One need not actually eat the matzah that has been hidden. There's only an obligation for one to ensure that matzah is the last thing that one eats that evening. But you can eat any piece of matzah. Children don't really know this. And we who grow up remembering this often don't know this as well. But in my home, growing up with a bunch of kids, siblings, we would hide the afikoman. And then we'd fall asleep. And my father would just say, okay. And he'd just take out another piece of matzah and eat that one instead. And then we'd forget where it was hidden. And then 3 months later, someone would sit on the couch cushion. You'd hear a crunch. And that would be, we'd find the afikoman. But what's essential to the ritual is the actual eating, that this is the last bite. The second ritual that, as children, many of us love is the pouring of what is called the cup of Elijah. And in many Ashkenazic versions of the Seder, not only the pouring of the cup of Elijah, but the opening of the door for him. Children, of course, take these rituals very seriously as well, looking to see if someone has sipped from the cup, rushing to the door, hoping to catch a glimpse of the famous prophet before Elijah magically whisks off to a different locale, to someone else's Seder on the other side of the world. So these two rituals are beloved. And yet, as they stand today, they are, at least in the names with which they are called, relatively new to the Seder. In the early rabbinic version of the Seder, the matzah eaten was never called afikoman. And even as late as the medieval period, no one at the Seder had a cup named after Elijah. And I will suggest that the evolution of the former, what we call the afikoman, will help us to better understand the evolution of the latter, the cup of Elijah, and how both of these rituals and what we call them today allow us to differentiate the culture that gave us the Seder, Judaism, from a culture to which it is often compared, and that is Greece, will allow us to differentiate Jerusalem from Athens, rabbinic Judaism, from the culture in which, according to many, the Seder as we know it, was first born. The word afikoman, now associated with the matzah that we eat, actually in the Haggadah itself, the text of the Haggadah, refers to something very different, not something we encourage, but rather the exact opposite. It appears, the word afikoman, in the response given to the wise son, when he asks, Ma'idot v'chukim v'mishpatim asher tzivah Hashem Elokeinu etchem, tell me all the laws of the Seder. And in response, we tell him the law, which is the last law of the Seder in Tractate Psachim, Ein maftirin achar ha-pesach afikoman, which means literally, after concluding the eating of the Paschal sacrifice, there is no afikoman to follow. The whole point of mentioning the afikoman is not about something you eat, but something you do not have. So what is this afikoman that we're being warned against? The answer lies in the ritual that, in the Greco-Roman age of the rabbis, is often compared to the Seder, and that is the Greek symposium. There, that symposium featured a stage that was called a word that sounds a lot like afikomen. Now, this explanation was first given, I believe, by Professor Saul Lieberman, but it has now been widely adopted. I quote one version of this approach from Gil Marx. He writes, "The formalized Passover night liturgy was developed by sages living in Israel 2,000 years ago at the time of the Roman occupation. They incorporated into the Seder not only the various biblical commandments, but also many elements from the contemporary Greco-Roman symposium." Symposium means drinking together. "The symposium was a ritualized upper-class banquet and intellectual dialogue, including reclining on couches, eating from private small tables, ritual hand-washing, dipping greens, consuming fruit and nut relishes, a series of ritual wine libations, a sumptuous meal, and a series of questions at a starting point for an intellectual discussion of a designated topic. These aspects of the symposium served as models of freedom and affluence, the ideals to which participants in the symposium aspired. At the end of the symposium, however, followed a komos, or later in Rome, a komisatio, named after an intoxicated, reveling group of satyrs who followed around the Greek god of wine and fertility, Dionysus." The word comedy, by the way, also comes from the word komos. "The end of the symposium, living up to the namesake komos, consisted of a drinking party accompanied with revelry, music, and song. The host always provided various tidbits, fruits, roasted grain, and nuts, to nosh on with the wine to induce the consumption of alcohol. The komos served as a ritualistic transition from the intellectual and gastronomic parts of the symposium to its sensual decadent side, inevitably and intentionally leading to lewdness. As part of the komos, the inebriated participants would then proceed from house to house, laughing and singing, to persuade others to join them in their drinking, carousing, and orgies. The sages, not wanting the aftermath of the Seder to degenerate into the bawdy and lascivious behavior of the komos, realized that it was necessary to avoid the excesses of the symposium. Consequently, afikomon meant in Greek epikomos or epikomion, which means upon the revelry. The meaning of the Mishnah is that one may not add after the Seder meal any of the activities associated with the komos." And this is what the wise son is taught. And the Haggadah, in other words, is stressing this law because it embodies what sets the Seder apart from the symposium. He wants to know, what are the laws of the Seder? And presumably he's taught all the laws, but what is stressed to him is the final law. What does it mean to celebrate a Seder? Ein maftirin achara pesach afikomen. Simply read, it means, don't do what the Greeks do. And fascinatingly, what then develops is that as Greek culture fades into antiquity, the Jews begin to call the last matzah that is eaten, which commemorates the last bite of the Paschal lamb, the afikomen. The food of faith, the food of law, the food of freedom, food of revelation. That becomes, as it were, our epikomos. It becomes our conclusion to the meal. But of course, instead of a drunken Dionysian revelry, instead of an ancient version of a Viennese table filled with sweets, all we have is more matzah. And what this teaches us is that while one may suggest, and many have suggested, that the Seder is rooted in and a parallel to the symposium, it can also be seen as a deliberate twisting of the symposium to give a rabbinic response to Greece. It responds politically, theologically, and ethically. And this is a theme, I would argue, that exists in the Seder, that existed in the Seder when it first came into being, but it became even more pronounced as the Seder evolved. And this difference was particularly pronounced as the Seder evolved long after the Greek symposium had ceased to be celebrated. In order to show how this is so, I will cite certain reflections from Leon Kass about the differences between Greek and Jewish texts. Dr. Kass, one of the great thinkers of our age, taught for many years Greek texts at the University of Chicago, and then began teaching Bible in seminars as well, and has written and delivered profound reflections on the primary differences between Greek and Jewish culture, or between Jerusalem and Athens. I will use these differences that he cites to illustrate how these differences are actually stressed, explicitly or implicitly, in the text of the Haggadah itself. The first difference that Dr. Kass stressed between the great Greek texts and the Hebraic texts is that, quote, "you don't get out of Plato and Aristotle an account that would sustain the view of the equal dignity of the human being, which for Judaism is founded on the notion that all are created in the image of God, and echoed in the teaching of the Sabbath, where not only masters but even their slaves rest as much as their masters. Whatever human distinction emerges because of human affairs, says Cass, nevertheless the ultimate human relation to the divine source and a kind of dignity has to be acknowledged. And therefore, he says, the Bible is the ultimate source of the kind of humanistic politics of the sort that we enjoy today. And that, I would add, is why Shabbat is called not only a remembrance of creation, Sabbath is also called a Zecher Liyetziat Mitzrayim, a remembrance of leaving Egypt. The rabbis, of course, lived in an age of slavery, but nevertheless, linked to the story of the Exodus, the slave resting on the Sabbath, in which everyone rests on the Sabbath. As the Torah says, you, your slave, your maidservant, the stranger in your gates, which meant for them that the Exodus story itself, like the Sabbath, was not only a Jewish story, though it is of course that, but it also reflects at its heart the equality of all mankind. Thus, we cannot overlook the significance of the fact that the one symposium of the Jewish year is actually to proclaim a story of freedom from slavery, a story that becomes the foundation of our humanistic politics in the West. And this itself is a striking separation from the heritage of Greece. Next, Cass notes that another big thing which is not Greek is honor your father and mother. The Greeks, of course, as he says, may have respected their fathers in a patriarchal society, may have wanted to imitate them, but they certainly did not have the notion of equal veneration for father and mother, which is linked for Judaism, as he explains, to the notion of both venerating our roots, but also of domesticating the male within Jewish society, keeping him at home in part by obligating him in transmission, honoring man first and foremost not as warrior or hero, but as father and transmitter and teacher. And this, of course, is the centerpiece of the Seder. And as I've noted, one of the most extraordinary differences between the Seder and the Symposium is that no high-level Greek symposium is inviting kids. And certainly no high-level Greek symposium is focused on kids. A high-level Greek symposium would be ruined in 2 seconds by kids. Wine would be spilled on Socrates, end of the Seder. That would be it. And the sages are well aware of this difference between their symposium and that of Athens. And so the obligation to teach the four sons is introduced with the words, Baruch HaMakom Shenatan Torah L'Amo Yisrael, Baruch Hu Keneged Arba'a Banim Dibra Torah. Blessed are you who gave the Torah to your people Israel. And then, without any segue, the Torah references four sons, teaching four sons. Meaning the rabbis are saying, what has made us elect? What has set us apart from other civilizations? Keneged Arba'a Banim Dibra Torah. The Greeks will do what they do, but God has chosen us, has given us the Torah, and He has given us the Torah for the purpose of transmission to our children, and He has given us the Torah because we as a culture have chosen to spend our time transmitting our truths to those who will take our place. And we revere as the ideal male, not the Greek warrior hero, not the Achilles, but Abraham, who is loved by God, as he himself says, Ki yedativ l'man asher yitzavet v'navet b'do acherav. I have known him, I have loved him, because I know that Abraham will command and teach his children and household after him, v'shamru et derech Hashem, that they will keep the ways of God, lasot tzedakah u'mishpat, to perform righteousness and justice. It is the male and female's role in continuity and transmission that is at the heart of Judaism and at the heart of the Seder. And this is a theme in the Seder that does not exist in the Symposium at all, and the rabbis knew this and they knew this well. And this pasuk, that Abraham will command his children to perform righteousness and justice, leads us to the next difference, which is the question of which is more important, justice or beauty. For Aristotle, the two seem to be somewhat connected. And the most noble quest for Aristotle is not, say, transmission to children. The most noble quest is the philosophical quest, to know the prime mover, to know a God who doesn't care for us, to know the eternal and the beautiful. Beautiful is greatly valued in Greek thought. For Aristotle, the purpose of the city, Cass says, is to produce the exemplary human beings. And the exemplary human beings are the beautiful human beings. Whereas from the Bible's point of view, nobility or the beautiful, he says, is not reliable when it comes to justice. For love of the beautiful, says Cass, lacks a fear of God, lacks an awe which can restrain man's darker passions. Interestingly, in his own discussion of the Seder, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik made the same point. In distinguishing between the Greek approach to the philosophical symposium and the Jewish attitude to the Seder, in distinguishing between Judaism's approach to beauty and Aristotle's praise of the cathartic value of beauty, Rabbi Soloveitchik, in a speech that was published in the book of his Passover writings, Festival of Freedom, says the following, quote, "Is beauty good? Is art cathartic by nature? Let me, Sadar Soloveitchik, put aside philosophic abstractions and relate to you a small incident which took place in Vilna during the German occupation. I have heard that there was a Gestapo officer," he said, "there who was an accomplished musician, an expert on Beethoven and Mozart, who was also an expert in killing children. He particularly liked to engage in both of his hobbies simultaneously. While he sat at a piano or organ in the courtyard of the Gestapo headquarters in Vilna, the Gestapo officers used to line up little babies and children. Ambidextrous, he played Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata with his right hand, while the left hand was busy shooting innocent babies, one by one. Is this, said Rabbi Soloveitchik, the kind of catharsis of which Aristotle spoke?" Leon Kass himself adds that the Greeks don't present the human being as being called by God to measure up, to justify the gift of God-likeness. The general theme in Greek poetry, Kass noted, is a tragic view, wherein we are creatures for a day, we are mortals, and the gods don't really care for us. They can best teach us, at best, not to be too big for our britches. But the Greeks are more focused on beauty, he says, than on justice. End quote. It is striking, therefore, that at the moment of our Seder's diversion from the Greek symposium, at the moment where we reject the epikomos, the darker side of man, at the moment when we eat the afikoman, what we have given, the name that we have given to the matzah, the food of law that we eat, what develops over time in the liturgy of the Seder at this point, right after we eat the afikoman, is a plea from God for justice in a world where justice seems to be non-existent. As soon as we eat our afikoman and we bless God for it, after we thereby, in our own afikoman, engage in our rejection of the Greek worldview, we then say, and in Ashkenazic Seders, Jews open the door and say this to the world, Shfoch chamatcha el hagoyim, asher lo yida'ucha, pour out your wrath on the nations who have known you not. This is not a base plea for vengeance, it is a plea for justice, as the paragraph goes on. Ki achal naveyam et Yaakov, for they have devoured your child Jacob. These nations have devoured us, and they are flourishing, and we are suffering. It is a plea for justice, and it is a statement that if the story of Passover is a tale not of an unmoved mover of Aristotle, but of a personal God who is Shofet Kol Haaretz, who judges all the earth, then is not Abraham right in his insistence that HaShofet Kol Haaretz Lo Yaseh Mishpat, shall not the judge of the world do justice? This is the plea for justice that we make at the moment right after the Afikoman, when we make clear our rejection of the Greek revelry. Right after we do not engage in the komos, and instead we eat what has become our Afikoman. And then, either right after, or for some immediately prior to Shvo Chamatcha, prior to this plea for justice, the fifth cup is poured, and what has become known as the cup of Elijah suddenly appears on our table. And this brings us to perhaps the most important and most central difference between Jerusalem and Athens. It was Kass who noted that the peak of the Aristotelian ethical virtues is the great-souled man, the man of consummate nobility, who goes in the city as if he were a god. And Aristotle stresses this several times. The great-souled man, listen to this phrase, quote, wonders at nothing because nothing is great to him. There is a suggestion, says Kass, that from the Greek point of view, there is nothing to be in awe of. Aristotle in his Ethics actually says that eidos, reverent awe, is not a virtue. It's a useful passion in the young, but a grown man has no reason to feel this. There is, he says, a specific attempt in Greek thought to cut off a veneration of something that is higher than the human. In contrast, in Judaism, what is stressed is not only man's potential greatness in the intellect with which he is endowed, but also the extraordinary lowness of his knowledge when compared to God. It's not just that Judaism stresses, as Socrates famously said, that wise people should also know what they do not know. It's that Judaism stresses that there is actually a value in awe, in the acknowledgement of that there are some things that we never can know or never can truly understand, but there is one who understands this, whose knowledge is far greater than ours. And so Judaism, in contrast to Athens, has a constant delicate balance between the greatness of man and the humility of man. Let me give you one story to illustrate this. In 2006, Dr. Yisrael Robert Aumann of Hebrew University was informed that he had been awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics for his groundbreaking work in game theory, and he was expected in Stockholm's Royal Palace so that he could be awarded this prestigious prize by the King of Sweden. Now, he's an Orthodox Jew, and the presentation of the Nobel Prize to an Orthodox Jew presented a number of unique challenges. First of all, each noble lord is only allowed to invite 16 guests. And for the almonds with 5 children, 19 grandchildren, and 2 great-grandchildren, not having the whole mishpacha was obviously unthinkable. Fortunately, Harold Pinter, noble lord for literature, declined to come and gave his 16 spots to the almonds. Then there was the royal banquet. I'm quoting an article. The Swedish royal family had wanted all food served there to be identical. And so the king chef agreed to share just this once his menu so that kosher versions of what the others were eating could be prepared. And I'm not sure how they did this because the Swedish chef's menu was crayfish with fennel-baked Arctic char and scallops and a Norwegian lobster on baby lettuce. But the most interesting challenge for almond lay in the dress code for the ceremony. As one article describes, every male present at the award ceremony, including even children, is required to wear tails and a white bow tie. Now, there's a problem for Dr. Almond, because since the Torah forbids wearing shatnez, a mixture of linen and wool, Professor Almond realized that he would have to have these garments checked for shatnez. This required having the chief rabbi of Sweden pick up one such outfit and bring it to Israel, where it could be checked with a microscope in one of Jerusalem's many shatnez labs. The examination revealed that the tuxedos were indeed shatnez, and so we are further informed, the Almond solved this problem by renting shatnez-free formal wear from an Israeli rental agency and having it flown to Stockholm for the ceremony. And this makes sense because Israel has long been known as a source of formal attire. Now, the truth is actually this is an incredibly striking story because shatnez is one of the commandments singled out by the sages as what they call a chok. It is an obligation that we obey without any full understanding as to its ultimate purpose. And Rabbi Soloveitchik, in his landmark essay, Majesty in Humility, describes what he termed in another essay, two different aspects of man, Adam the First and Adam the Second. Adam the First is majestic. He seeks to fulfill the Almighty's instruction in Eden to conquer the world, achieve scientific breakthroughs, cure disease, build cities and countries, serve as the Almighty's partner in creation. But then there is Adam the Second, man who is aware of his finitude, who seeks not to conquer but to return to his roots, not to be majestic but to humble himself before his omnipotent, omniscient creator. Judaism recognizes both Adams as being inherent in our nature, both willed by God. And Rabbi Soloveitchik further notes that the union in the Torah of both what's called mishpat and what's called chok, laws that can easily be understood and laws that defy attempt at human explanation, these together represent the majesty and humility of human nature. On the one hand, there are some laws that God gives that we, our minds, which are created in the image of God, can actually intuit and understand. And yet, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, precisely because of the supremacy of the intellect in human life, the Torah requires at times the suspension of the authority logos. Man defeats himself by accepting norms that the intellect cannot assimilate into its normative system. The Judaic concept of chok represents human surrender, he says. A man burdens himself with laws whose rational motif he cannot grasp. So ladies and gentlemen, here you have Robert Almond. He has lived the life of the mind. His institute, as an article notes, at Hebrew University is called the Center for Rationality. And yet, at the pinnacle of his achievement, when he's being honored for his intellect, there he observes shatnez, whose very essence embodies the notion that there is many a thing that the human mind, no matter how gifted, cannot comprehend. A law that embodies for the rabbis of Rabbi Soloveitchik, Hamlet's notion that there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. Think of the dichotomy, the dialectic, of a man receiving the Nobel Prize. We're not talking about something like the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, they give that to pretty much anybody, okay? He's receiving the Nobel Prize for economics from the king of Sweden in his shatnez-free tuxedo, attired in the formal wear of the palace that is simultaneously tailored to the dictates of Jewish law, thereby embodying at the same time human greatness and limitation, what's called in Hebrew gadlut ha'adam and shiflut ha'adam, rationality and faith, or as per Rabbi Soloveitchik, majesty and humility. Thus, in Judaism, a confidence in the mind of man is constantly paired with awe in the presence of an omniscient, almighty God. And this dialectic differentiates us from Athens. Rabbi Soloveitchik's son-in-law, similar to Cass's point, put it this way. The Greeks, he said, believed that existence in its totality is comprehensible. The universe contains no mystery. Man can master all creation. He says today's conception of mastery is different. We think of dominating the world in the physical sense, to harness its power. But the Greek conception of mastery meant domination through conceptualization and categorization. Their purpose was for the sake of understanding. Judaism, in contrast, he says, Judaism does place man at the center of creation as one who dominates the world. But both man and his world are null and void for Judaism in the presence of God before the hidden and secret being. Religious man experiences humility and insignificance in the presence of God. And he concludes, the problem with Greece was not its belief in multiple deities, but rather in its deification of man. And the fact that it stressed man's greatness, which led to their extraordinary achievements, but did not balance it with the humility of man before God. So Judaism, contra Athens, offers us a dialectic. Confidence in man and his intellect, and humility in the presence of God before whom our knowledge is nothing. This brings us back to Elijah. In the Talmud, as a work, as a corpus, this dialectic in Judaism and its worldview can be seen. On the one hand, the Talmud is the greatest achievement of the Jewish mind, and perhaps the greatest achievement of the mind of man as an intellectual work in the history of the world. At the same time, the rabbis are open about the fact that there are many things that they do not know, and indeed many questions that they will not resolve. And it is in this situation that Elijah enters. In Talmudic Judaism, Elijah, the prophet who was not quite human, the man who was taken alive into heaven, the man who never died, the man who will come to announce the arrival of the Messianic age, Elijah is always invoked when it comes to unresolved questions in the Talmud. Regarding objects or money that are subjects of litigation, when the questions cannot be answered, but who is the owner, it is stated, Yehi munach ad sheyavo Eliyahu. Let it stay until Elijah comes. Let it remain until the end times resolve these questions. When the Talmud has an unresolved question of Jewish law, it ends with the word teiku, hundreds of times in the Talmud. In modern Hebrew, it is used to refer to a tie in a game of soccer. So it's used very often because, as far as I can tell, every soccer game ends in a tie. Originally it means we leave this matter unresolved. Or as tradition understands it, the word teiku, taf yud kuvav, stands for the phrase Tishbi Yitaret Kushiot Va'abayot. Tishbi, meaning Elijah the Tishbiite, Elijah the prophet, will answer unresolved questions in the end of days. That is what teiku means. Rabbi Soloveitchik, again, in speaking in Yiddish once, remarked that as a child learning the Talmud, he asked his father, he said, these are brilliant men. Their brilliance is evident in the Talmudic text. Why are there so many teikus? Why so many unresolved questions? And his father said to him that they were left unresolved to teach Jews a lesson. In his words, as a yid muz wissen, as a dazachen vaser vesnet, that a Jew must know that there are things that he does not know. And Rabbi Soloveitchik stressed that this was not just things that he doesn't know because he lacks certain knowledge that he may one day get. It's not just in the Socratic sense that you know certain things you don't know. It's at the heart of our faith that there are things that we cannot know. Or as he put it, his father's response to him as a child was, as he said in Yiddish, nit nor a yesed in halacha, not only a principle in Jewish law, it is a yesed in ikore emuna. It is a principle at the heart of the very foundations of our faith. We combine a belief in the brilliance of the mind of man and a belief in the achievements, or the potential achievements of the Jewish mind, with a humbling of the Jewish mind before the omniscience of God. And a faith that allows us to believe in a just and good and all-wise God, even when we cannot explain his choices and his actions, in the knowledge that, as Rabbi Soloveitchik puts it, teiku, a Jew must know that there are things that he cannot know. This brings us to the fifth cup. It is taken for granted by many today that we are specifically obligated to drink only four cups of wine at the Seder. Indeed, the Mishnah itself stresses that at the Seder, one should have no less than four cups. And the Jerusalem Talmud explains that these parallel the Arba Lishonot Shel Geula, the four phrases of redemption that God invokes in guaranteeing the Exodus. As he says, therefore say to the Israelites, I am the Lord, Vo'tzeiti etchem, I will take you out, that's one, from under the yoke of the Egyptians. V'ga'alti etchem, and I will free you from being slaves to them. V'yitzalti etchem, I will save you from being slaves to them. V'ga'alti etchem, I will redeem you. V'lakachti etchem li la'am, and I will take you to me as a people. However, in the Babylonian Talmud, one line appears which says as follows. Rabbi Tarfon says, on the fifth cup, one completes the Hallel and then says Hallel HaGadol, the great Hallel, which is an additional psalm of praise. These are the words, says the Talmud, of Rabbi Tarfon. So many of the Ashkenazic sages, including Rashi, find this very strange. Where does this fifth cup come from? So they amend the text and say it must be that this is a reference to the fourth cup. There is no fifth cup. If you look, however, in Rambam's codification of the law, it is clear that he and most of the rabbis of Sfarad originally had the manuscript which said, on the fifth cup, you continue the Seder, and so Rambam rules that it must be that there is an elective fifth cup, which is to be added as well. And this makes sense because if the four cups parallel the four phrases that God uses in proclaiming the Exodus, if you study the text of the Torah, you will see that there actually is a fifth phrase, a fifth verb that God uses. After he says, I will take you to me as a people, he says what? V'heveti etchem, I will bring you to the land. So there is a fifth verb, a fifth phrase of redemption. And so the question is, does that deserve a fifth cup? So we have a debate. In the medieval period, some Jews had four, some Jews had five cups at their Seder. Having five cups at the Seder was quite usual for some medieval Sephardic Seders. And you guys are thinking, I barely survive with four. How are we getting to five? But what happens ultimately? Ultimately, as the diverse views are collected, a debate seems to have ensued, and the question remains. Or as Rabbi Sacks succinctly summarizes, hence the extra cup at the Seder table. Out of respect for Rambam, we pour it. Out of respect for Rashi, we do not drink it. Unresolved halachic disputes for the sages are one day resolved by who? Elijah. Teku, tishbi yitaretz kushiyot v'abayot. Hence the fifth cup becomes known as the cup of Elijah. End quote. Or as I would say it, and here I would put a slightly different spin on it. Elijah is invoked here, not only because his arrival is a harbinger of the end times. His name is applied to this questionable cup, the cup that we're not sure whether we should drink or not, because we're not sure what the Talmudic text actually says. His name is applied to the questionable cup because it is the one of which we are unsure, meaning that the fifth cup as it develops, and it only develops this way at the end and the transition from the medieval period into the time of the Acharonim, the post-medieval sages. It is the cup of unresolved questions, the cup that represents the limits of human understanding. Understood this way, the entire Seder is a process that shows us Judaism's belief in man's intellectual capacity while also stressing the limitations of that capacity. Think about the structure of the Haggadah. Throughout the first part of the Haggadah, the confidence in it, what's expressed is confidence in intelligence and human inquiry. Again and again, what happens is questions are asked, and we're supposed to inspire our children to ask more questions. There are the four questions, and they have answers. We are presented with a variety of verses, and every verse has an interpretation. Every query has a response. Numerous brilliant exegetical insights are offered. The symbolic foods of the Seder all are explained. The power of the mind of man is made manifest at the Seder. Through the Haggadah, the power of the creative, interpretive mind of the rabbis is on display. But then, as the meal comes to an end, and the afikoman is eaten, which signifies, as it stands today, our rejection of the Greek way of life, all of a sudden, many Jews stand up and recite a plea, Shfok Hamatcha, bestow just punishment on the evildoers of the world. To the Jews who are opening their doors and standing in the open doorways of their ghettos or in the shtetl pale of persecution, the implicit question is obvious. They are asking a question, but it is a question to which they do not have the answer because it is a question that cannot be answered by the mind of man. Why, if we believe in a God of justice, is the world he created so very much lacking in that justice? But unlike all the other questions that have been asked up till this point, this one has no answer. And it is an implicit acknowledgement of this, that prior to this plea, the cup of Elijah is poured, the cup that represents the notion that unlike Athens, Jerusalem humbles itself in awe before the omniscient being, whom, as God informs Job, was there alone when the world came into being. This is Judaism, the balancing of questions with the ability to faithfully and loyally live a Jewish life, even when the most profound questions cannot be answered. Or as Rabbi Soloveitchik put it, precisely because of the supremacy of the intellect in human life, the Torah requires that man defeat himself by accepting norms that the intellect cannot assimilate. That is Jewish faith, combining human inquiry with questions that cannot be answered. As such, the text of the Haggadah stands today, and the Seder as it is performed by so many, allows us to understand, actually, why, even if it drew on Greek practice, we as Jews are still engaging in the Seder, in the Symposium of the Jews, with Greece and Rome long gone, with no Socratic symposium performed for centuries. Truth is, as suspense-filled as many children find the door opening, for many of us adults in 21st century America, the ritual has lost a lot of its charm. and certainly all of its suspense. The theologian Harvey Cox, a Christian professor at Harvard Divinity School, wrote a book about his experiencing of Jewish ritual. And he described how at the Seder, he watches as a child is dispatched to fling open the door, and Cox writes, quote, "If no one is there, none of the dinner guests seem too upset. There are smiles and jokes, maybe in part because the adults have already consumed the Seder's prerequisite cups of wine. Jews," he writes, "have performed this ritual for generations, only to be disappointed. After all," Cox concludes, "they have been waiting for millennia. They have been waiting for millennia." And indeed, the word wait is the operative word. An old Yiddish anecdote describes how one shtetl hired a watchman to stand at the city gate in order to wait and watch, in order to alert the town when he saw the Messiah riding his donkey rounding the bend with Elijah in front of him proclaiming the way. When the watchman is asked why he chose this strange career, the watchman replied, "Well, the pay's not so good, but it's a lifetime job." Waiting and yet believing is indeed the Jewish lifetime job. We do not understand the extraordinary faith that goes into the fifth cup. Not just because it's a standalone ritual, but because of what it represents, it balances out what the rest of the Haggadah is as a work. The Haggadah is about the belief in the power of human interpretation of the Torah. Creative exegetical insights are applied. Different verses, seemingly about the same son, are shown to be revealed to be about four different sons entirely. One makkah is, through the brilliance of interpretation, revealed to be 10 makkot. 50 makkot is revealed to be 250 makkot. Exegetical brilliance is everywhere. Creativity is on display. But then, of course, comes the ultimate question. And for us, we miss out on this question because we are not opening our doors in a ghetto or in a village in the Middle East or in Iraq where Jews are second-class citizens, if they're lucky. We are not doing that. We do not understand what it means to face questions that the human mind cannot fail to ask and yet simultaneously combine the question with the humility and the awe and the Yirat Hashem to continue to celebrate Pesach without an answer to that question. Michael Wishegrad, the theologian who has had a great impact on me, once wrote a critique of the Holocaust philosopher Irving Greenberg, who himself had written that in the face of the Holocaust, in the moment of pondering the Holocaust, one cannot actually believe at that moment in a redeeming God. And Wishegrad, whose family itself escaped Germany after Kristallnacht, concluded his own critique by saying, reiterating the point that he makes throughout the article, that for Jews, Pesach, is the notion of the redeeming God, is what we bear with us, even when we face questions which the human mind cannot understand. And he concludes by saying, "Recently I attended the wedding of the daughter of a Warsaw ghetto survivor to the son of another survivor. The blessing spoke of the creation of man in the image of God, of the joy of the childless woman whom God has made fertile, and whose sons are gathered about her, and of the joyous sounds of grooms and brides in the cities of Judah and the streets of Jerusalem. There was great joy at that wedding. There was, of course, also the sense of absence of all those who should have been there but were not. They were not forgotten by any means, but the redeeming God of Israel was also not forgotten. If after the Holocaust we have children who in turn beget children, if we can smile and laugh at jokes and satisfy our normal human appetites, if in short we have not gone mad, it is because we trust in the God of our fathers. He will reward those who have perished and punish those who have committed the evil. He watches over this nation even when it does not seem so. We believe this fairly steadily, and not only for moments." To show the belief in the unresolved question, to say Shvoch Hamatcha, and then to pour the cup of Elijah, and then to say what follows, which is praise of God in the face of all the injustice in the world, and the unfulfilled prayer, and the unanswered query, "Shall not the judge of the world do justice?" That is the heart of the endurance of the Jewish people. Leon Kass himself, at the end of his discussion of Judaism in Athens, reflected why, after decades of teaching Greek texts, he decided to start teaching seminars about the Bible. And he says he realized that the culture in America was truly in tatters, and one needed something more democratic, more foundational, that touched more the ethics of everyday life, and duty and self-command and self-respect and regard for neighbor, all the things which are much closer to the teachings of biblical religion, he said, than are the lofty peaks of Aristotle's great-souled man and warrior courage. "Much as we need those things still," he said, "I don't want to make it a strict either-or," said Cass. And I want to stress, I myself, in this lecture on Jerusalem and Athens, don't want to make it a strict either-or. But, said Cass, if you asked me if I wanted to do good for young Americans, as they now come out of the culture, do I want to sit them down and teach them the great-souled man, or do I want them to meet Moses? If forced to choose, I choose Moses. The insights of the Haggadah, and especially the insights that differentiate it from Egypt, as we discussed in earlier lectures, and from Athens, as we discussed this evening. This is the wisdom that America needs. This is the universal political wisdom that the Haggadah offers. But even as we discuss throughout these lectures the Haggadah as a political masterpiece, we must still continue to see it also as the particularistic text and the tale of Jewish faith that it is. And ultimately, this story that the Haggadah in its evolution, as it stands today, with four cups and a fifth cup, with questions that are all answered, and the consummate question that cannot be answered. The four cups that are drunk, and the cup of faith that is awaiting Elijah. This, as a particularistic text, and as a profoundly Jewish ritual, speaks first and foremost not only of political wisdom, but also of the faith and the enduring courage of Jews who were surrounded by those who hated them, and yet celebrated in slavery the festival of freedom. And as every year they poured that fifth cup, they waited hopefully and expectantly for a knock at the door. Thank you very much.